the more threatening the situation. In the past, the U.S. has been more prepared to make a deal and compromise.
North Korea may be building new missiles. It's Wednesday, August 1st. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. You're also welcome to join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, Cambodia's ruling party in full control, new U.S. investment in Asia, lobsters caught in tariffs, clean breathing in Hanoi, saving arms and legs, futuristic travel. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Military officials from North and South Korea met Tuesday at the border village of Panmunjom in a renewed effort to build trust amid a thaw in cross-border relations. The two Koreas have agreed to discuss reductions in weapons and military personnel along their demilitarized zone, or DMZ. The talks took place as a senior U.S. official said satellites have detected renewed activity at the Samundong facility that produced the country's first intercontinental ballistic missiles, even as the U.S. pursues denuclearization talks with Pyongyang. The Washington Post, citing unidentified reports and officials, reported Monday the North appeared to be building one or two new liquid-fueled missiles. Bruce Bennett is a senior defense analyst at the RAND Corporation. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty the North's motivation is unclear. Either it is simply pursuing activities it has engaged in the past, or is deliberately pursuing activities it knows the United States will see as a way to extract further concessions.
The North wants an end to the economic sanctions against the North, and so they may be sending out images in a way that they're hoping will push the U.S. to make more compromise.
In June, U.S. officials told U.S. media outlets intelligence agencies believe the North has increased production of fuel for nuclear weapons, and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said as much before the U.S. Senate just last week.
Yeah, the North has learned over the years that the more threatening the situation. In the past, the U.S. has been more prepared to make a deal and compromise. The problem, of course, is that President Trump isn't necessarily the past president. If he gets pushed too hard, that could turn out bad for North Korea, and they may not be adequately recognizing that.
Generals from the two Koreas met Tuesday at their shared border for talks meant to ease tensions and the military standoff. This comes as the North repatriated, we're told, a number of American remains from the Korean conflict. How is the denuclearization process going, in your view?
I think we haven't seen much in the way of denuclearization. I mean, if you were to rank the facilities that we would be concerned about, the ones that North Korea has talked about and done something about, the nuclear testing facility, a launch stand for a missile, those would be at the bottom of the list. They would not be of significant interest because here's North Korea producing more fissile material and producing potentially more missiles. It's the production facilities that we want to get under control, and there's no movement on getting those under control. There's also no movement on reducing the nuclear weapons or the missiles themselves. And the North had said at the end of last year that their program was mature. So for them to destroy a couple of test facilities when their program is, according to their own statement, mature, that's no big deal. They're not really giving the U.S. very much at this stage.
Bruce Bennett said the latest development should cause some concern within the Trump administration. He said since North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's charm offensive began in January, the North has not denuclearized but continues to nuclearize, adding to its growing arsenal of weapons. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find currently trending on VOAnews.com. North Korea tops Pompeo agenda at Asia's security meeting. Vietnam floods kill three, threaten to submerge parts of Hanoi. Japan asks Russia to reduce military activity on disputed islands. Thailand asks Britain to extradite convicted former Prime Minister Yingluck. China urges United States not to allow stopover by Taiwan president. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia. You'll also find them and a whole lot more on VOAnews.com. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. In Cambodia, the ruling party says it has won every seat in parliament. Sunday's election was slammed by rights groups as a sham because the main opposition party was banned. The Cambodian People's Party said it now controls all 125 seats in the National Assembly. CPP figures show voters' second most popular choice was to spoil their ballots, despite the government's threats against those considering using their constitutional right to boycott the election. Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen is now set to extend his already 33-year reign by another five, free of any real opposition party. Late last year, the CPP's only real opponent in the election, the Cambodia National Rescue Party, was dissolved, and its leader, Kem Sokha, jailed on widely derided allegations it was fomenting an internationally backed plot to overthrow the government. Joshua Kurlansich is a senior fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he shares his reaction with VOA's Sarah Williams.
Cambodia wasn't a democracy before. It was sort of a something of a flawed hybrid regime, but now it's become a full-on autocracy run by Hun Sen, the prime minister. I mean, I think it means there's probably going to be some degree more repression, and there's no real blocks against Hun Sen. I'm not sure in practicality it changes that much, since Hun Sen was in a fair degree of control before, but it definitely further limits the scope for any sort of limitations on Hun Sen's power.
And what about the state of the opposition? So many opposition leaders are now in exile, if not in prison.
Yeah, many are in exile in prison, or some, there are some still in Cambodia, but they're especially in terms of civil society opposition leaders, but they're scared. I don't have one good answer. It's possible Hun Sen will try to co-opt some of them, which is something he's done in the past, and sort of restore some degree of normalcy and slightly more open environment. It's also possible that he sees this as like the determining year, the determining time, and this is just going to become an all-out autocracy, and that their options would be to try to rally street protests or some sort of aggressive sort of, I don't want to say violent, but some sort of aggressive non-street or non-ballot box type repercussion in response. But right now, the opposition is pretty much shattered.
Kem Lay, who was an activist 2 years ago, was assassinated. Before his assassination, he had been very critical of Hun Sen, particularly because the organization Global Witness had put out a report saying Hun Sen's family was worth a minimum of $200 million. Considering what has happened since, and I believe an investigation was supposed to take place regarding that killing, but nevertheless, when you think about what has happened, I mean, does this mean that Hun Sen could, he and particularly his family moving forward, try to accumulate, extend power, say, into the next generation and continue to accumulate more wealth?
Well, I think that there was an investigation into the killing, although the question is that they placed the blame on a man who seems unlikely that he was behind the killing, and there are some even questions about his mental capabilities. Yeah, I mean, I think Hun Sen is probably potentially preparing to try to hand power over time to one of his sons and or others in his family, yes.
Before the latest election, there were a number of media organizations like Voice of America, also Radio Free Asia, that their websites were shut down. It was impossible for people in Cambodia to view them. I mean, it does seem, again, that the government of Hun Sen is really limiting the access of its citizens to a free media.
Right. Well, I mean, VOA and RFA were just part of a broader campaign against free media, which included forcing the closure of the Cambodia Daily and not the closure, but really seriously undermining the Phnom Penh Post, which were two important and independent media outlets, as well as forcing the closure of a number of opposition or just simply independent radio stations in Cambodia that provided an alternative to state news. So all of those things together definitely suggest that Hun Sen has decided to dramatically try to limit people's options for accessing news. I don't know if he's going to be successful in the long term because Cambodia's internet is still relatively more free than some of the most repressive states in the region, but he's definitely trying to curtail independent news outlets.
Joshua Kurlansich is a senior fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. Happening now in Asia, a new government commission probing human rights abuses in Myanmar's Rakhine State is being criticized by skeptics a day after it was announced. Human Rights Watch says the real power in the country is the army, not the government, and the army needs to allow an independent investigation. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us on VOA Asia. The Trump administration has offered what it calls its vision for a free and open Indo-Pacific region, with American business investment at the center of it and aimed at peace, stability, and prosperity. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo addressed the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Monday as he prepared to leave for a trip to Malaysia, Singapore, and Indonesia. The initial outlay of $113 million is being billed as a down payment on what Pompeo described as a new era of U.S. economic commitment. The three-part plan includes funds for technology, energy, and infrastructure among ASEAN nations of Southeast Asia. Ankit Panda is associate director of the Asia Current Events publication, The Diplomat. He tells VOA the Trump administration is downplaying any idea. This is direct competition with China's massive Belt and Road development initiative.
The United States, along with Japan and Australia and even India, has been publicly quite supportive of the idea of supporting a high standards-based infrastructure regime in Asia. So even though the numbers aren't quite there, I think the administration thinks that, you know, U.S. partners, allies, and other states in the region will see this as the start of a growing U.S. interest. And also, I think a lot of regional partners are aware of the different economic natures of the Chinese and U.S. governments, in the sense that the U.S. does not have the ability for the government itself to leverage large amounts of capital because U.S. private industry plays a much bigger role in FDI, whereas in China you have the massive state-owned enterprise sector that the Communist Party can effectively leverage as it sees fit for geopolitical ends.
Bonnie Glaser, director of the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, said the United States initiative could help reassert America's influence in the region and ease growing concerns about its ability to sustain its commitments beyond defense. Coming up, lobster harvesters are feeling the pinch of trade tariffs. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Your requests, your dedications, and interviews and performances by your favorite music superstars. It's Border Crossings. This is Larry London. Be sure to tune in every Monday through Friday at 15 hours Universal Time on VOA or online at voanews.com. You've got control. Border Crossings, weekdays at 15 hours Universal Time at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This news from VOA Asia. Malaysia's civil aviation chief says he has resigned to take responsibility after an independent investigative report highlighted shortcomings in the air traffic control center during Malaysia Airlines Flight 370's disappearance 4 years ago. You'll always find VOA Asia Facebook online. Visit today. This is VOA Asia. Now, as VOA Asia continues, trade tariffs, claw at lobsters, and the business of cleaning the air in Hanoi are the topics on this week's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
Lobstermen in Maine are worried about the future of the industry as the tariff war between China and the U.S. continues. Last week, China imposed a 25% tariff on U.S. lobster exports, forcing Chinese importers to look for other markets. The duties came in response to tariffs posed by U.S. President Donald Trump on Chinese goods. Michael Marceau, who owns the lobster company in Arundel, Maine, is worried about what's to come.
That's a hand grenade in business. When something happens that quickly, that devastating.
China is the biggest overseas market for U.S. lobster sales. The industry was on track to more than double sales this year, with export data showing sales of $75.3 million through June, compared with $34.2 million over that same period in 2017. Now, business owners like Marceau are worried they might have to downsize.
Most of our employees have been with us a long time. We do Shanghai, Shenzhen, Beijing. Hong Kong, 12 years ago, imported maybe 300,000 or 400,000 pounds a year. Now they take 6-7 million.
Lobster is pivotal to livelihoods in Maine, with approximately 4,500 men and women licensed to catch and another 10,000 working on other areas of the industry. A group of Democrats is pushing for disaster aid for seafood harvesters affected by the tariffs, but nothing has passed the U.S. Congress yet. Hanoi is making a big investment in cleaning up its air pollution. In its fight, the Hanoi City Council this month approved a ban on motorcycles by 2030, hoping to boost public transport. Jason McInerney is a U.S. environmental and health officer.
In any capital city in the world, the four most common contributors will be vehicle emissions, power plants, in particular coal power plants, agricultural burning in season when that burning season is, and if it is present, industrial emissions. And from what I've seen in Hanoi, I suspect that would be that general pattern that's true worldwide would, I believe, also apply here in Hanoi.
Home to 7.7 million people, Hanoi's pollution levels last year were four times higher than what the World Health Organization considers acceptable. This year, Hanoi recorded 10 clean air days in the second quarter, higher than the corresponding period in 2016 and 2017. In an effort to keep that trend going, the city council also planted 80% of a target of 1 million trees and is encouraging people to replace petrol with cleaner biofuels and use cleaner burning heaters. But challenges remain. Coal still provides the bulk of electricity for Vietnam's fast-growing economy, which is expected to grow more than 6% this year for the fourth time. Without an alternative source of income, many in the industry are reluctant to make the switch to a cleaner energy source. Trina Van Thai is the owner of the Honeycomb Coal Factory.
No, I won't stop this business. I'll do this until the coal runs out. I don't know what else to do for a living except this.
Hanoi is one of several major Southeast Asian cities battling emissions from vehicles and industrial activity. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia. Officials in Hanoi say seasonal floods have killed three people and threatened to submerge parts of Vietnam's capital. Two children and a man drowned Monday in the Chuang Mai district, where water has overflowed one bank of the Bui River and engulfed several villages. Take a minute to read and see more on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, for more than 30 years, doctors have worked to save people's arms and legs. VOA's Carol Pearson reports saving a limb after an accident or infection can take an entire team of specialists at a limb preservation center.
That was a kick to the ball from an athlete on Nigeria's amputee football team. Everyone on this team is missing a leg or an arm. But these athletes have an eye on winning the World Amputee Football Federation's World Cup in Mexico this fall. With prosthetics, amputees can do things almost as well as, or even better than, whole-bodied people. Of course, most people prefer not to lose a limb. Jeff Bope nearly lost his arm after an accident in a utility vehicle when the driver lost control. The vehicle flipped. Bope's arm snapped, and the muscle and skin were torn away.
The way they described it in the medical reports, it was a near-field amputation.
Bope was flown to the University of Missouri Healthcare's Trauma Center.
Met him in the emergency room. We were concerned we may not be able to save his arm.
Dr. Jay Bridgman, a limb reconstruction specialist at the University of Missouri Healthcare, was called in.
We took a muscle from his back, and we used that to lay over the areas that were exposed that had lost tissue. And then that required the skill of the microsurgeon to sew the blood vessels together and the nerves together.
After more than a dozen surgeries, Bridgman says these procedures helped save Bope's hand.
What's key for him that he will have that's better than a prosthesis is a hand that has sensation, so he can feel objects and use the hand.
Saving limbs requires a team of doctors with different specialties. At the Cleveland Clinic, Dr. Lee Kirksey says the majority of patients who get limb-saving surgeries have diabetes.
About one-third of diabetics at some point will develop an ulcer on their feet. And so where I see this area of limb salvage progressing is that we'll become better and more skilled and have more technology in restoring blood flow for these patients.
There will always be patients whose limbs can't be saved, which is why there is a great focus on making better prosthetics.
What we focus on in that case is getting that patient a well-constructed amputation of some sort, getting them into a prosthetic, and then they're wildly surprised about how they're able to achieve a normal activity level in their life.
Carol Pearson, VOA News.
A sleek, futuristic train that travels through a special tunnel and covers the distance between Los Angeles and San Francisco in 30 minutes was the dream of Elon Musk, the founder of SpaceX. And every year since that dream began in 2013, he's been getting closer to making it a reality. Late July was marked by the third annual Hyperloop Pod Competition in Los Angeles, a competition Jenny DeLute tells us has once again set a new speed record.
...467 kilometers per hour, or nearly 300 miles an hour. That's a new speed record set by World Hyperloop, a team of German engineering students at the third annual Hyperloop Pod Competition in Los Angeles. All told, more than 600 teams from around the world took part in a contest. 20 made it to the finals, but only 3 were chosen to have their pods tested in a specially built vacuum tunnel just over a kilometer long.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The main criteria was speed.
And we tried different designs, so one big motor, 2 big motors on the same shaft. That was also a pretty cool idea. But in the end, we saw these very small motors, and these have a very good power-to-weight ratio, so we went with that solution. The simulations just showed that this would be the best option to go.
But there were unexpected difficulties. Among the challenges, say engineers, electronic components that were not designed to work in a vacuum.
We bought just these cells. We pressed them all together with these packs. We 3D printed the entire structure that goes around it. We did all the tests of the performance ourselves. Basically, that gives you the reliability that the cells, when they are exposed to vacuum, they can expand, and that could be a risk for explosion or a battery fire. So when you keep them inside the pressure vessel, you are sure that will not happen.
But that's not the only problem engineers want to solve. A team from the Netherlands says a fully functioning Hyperloop transport system would make short flights obsolete, along with the harm they bring to the environment.
Short distance aviation, 1,000, 1,500 kilometers. That is the kind of transportation in which we think a leap in quality is still needed. So that's what Hyperloop will be used for. So we'll use station distance of like 500 kilometers, which means we can connect like Amsterdam, Brussels, Paris, or Amsterdam, Berlin.
SpaceX CEO and Hyperloop sponsor Elon Musk says the competition is about pushing boundaries.
What this competition is about is encouraging people to think about new modes of transport, things that could radically transform cities and the way people get around, and really testing that's going to be a radical improvement.
This year's competition shows engineers are getting close. Jenya Dulo for VOA News, Los Angeles.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online at VOA Asia Facebook and, of course, our website, voanews.com. You'll also find us on the radio around Asia, great radio stations like Radioactive at Temasek Polytechnic in Singapore. Thanks to everyone there who's tuned in today to our program. And our program is made possible by some great people. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Thomas Blondet, managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team including Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.